21-1679 CR State versus Gary L. Gordon. We haven't seen for a while, Mr. Freiman. arguing for the State Assistant Attorney General, Freiman. I'm in a row for you to the State to argue first is very unusual.
Is it? Am I setting a precedent?
But you do it so well.
Thank you.
I think you've done that before, correct?
I've had two different days, not on the same day, though. May it please the court, I am James Freiman with Assistant Attorney General, representing the state as petitioner in this criminal appeal. On August 2, 2000, a jury found defendant Gary Gordon guilty of one felony, second-degree recklessly endangering safety, and two misdemeanors, disorderly conduct while armed, and violating a domestic abuse injunction. Before this case concerns just the conviction of disorderly conduct while armed. The Court of Appeals reversed on the two misdemeanors, and the state's issues both relate to that conviction, that charge that was overturned. Before addressing the issues in the state's position, I'd just like to quickly outline the main facts from the trial. The convictions stem from a single episode. Two Milwaukee police officers arrived at Margaret Wilder's residence in response to a report that Gordon was violating a domestic abuse injunction. At trial, Mr. Gordon admitted picking up two knives inside the residence to facilitate fleeing from the police. He admitted refusing repeated police commands to drop the knives, swearing at the police, and vowing that he wasn't going to jail. He then fled outside with the knives, causing a police search. When one officer encountered Mr. Gordon in a backyard, Mr. Gordon still had the knives, and when Mr. Gordon allegedly stepped forward and raised the knife, allegedly, the officer shot and wounded Mr. Gordon. There are two issues that the state's petition for review has presented. The first concerns a novel question in Wisconsin law of ineffective assistance of trial counsel. On this issue, the state would ask this court to hold as follows. In a multi-count case that goes to trial, whether jury trial or court trial, a defense counsel may, at closing argument, under proper circumstances, which I will address in a minute, unilaterally concede the defendant's guilt of a lesser charge to enhance the prospect of acquittal on a greater charge. Mr. Gordon's case presents such proper circumstances. Contrary to the Court of Appeals analysis on this issue, in proper circumstances, counsel's unilateral, that is, without obtaining consent from Mr. Gordon, unilateral concession of guilt of a lesser charge will not constitute an unauthorized guilty plea and will not automatically constitute ineffective assistance of counsel. Rather, the state's position is that this should be analyzed under the Strickland two-prong test, in which case the entirety of the circumstances are considered. In the state's brief, the state has outlined four factors that it believes should invariably. I'm sorry.
Before you get into that, counsel, I just want to make sure that we've got this correct. The state is conceding that this was a concession of guilt and that it was done without the client's consent.
That's correct. Well, it was remanded to the trial court to determine whether there was consent. It wasn't determined for sure. I'm sorry. Yeah, we're taking the position if there was no consent and that no consent was necessary in this case, okay, that counsel could do it as a matter of strategy.
And that this is the same as counsel pleading guilty.
We're saying that this is not the equivalent of a guilty plea.
Okay, but it is a unilateral concession of defendant's guilt.
That's correct.
And so a unilateral concession of defendant's guilt is not the equivalent of a plea of guilty to that count, because if you said that, then you'd be out of court on that count. Right? Because Bangert and everything else, you have to have a colloquy and the defendant has to do it firstly.
Well, that's part of the problem, I think, with the Court of Appeals analysis here, because they're suggesting this was like a guilty plea, and yet they're saying that all you need to do is go back and see whether he consented to the concession. I'm saying that wouldn't work if this was really a guilty plea.
Right, because you'd have to go through a colloquy, and he has to do it personally.
Right. I'm saying this isn't a guilty plea for a couple of reasons.
Pardon me?
This is not a guilty plea for several reasons. There was no waiver of Mr. Gordon's trial rights. Defense counsel, indeed the state witnesses, were cross-examined on the disorderly conduct charge, and Gordon was able to testify about it himself. Counsel did not stipulate to any element of the disorderly conduct charge, and there was no jury instruction requiring jurors to accept any element as proven. Before getting into the four circumstances that are present in this case that I think shows that there was no ineffective assistance under Strickland, I just want to make sure that I articulate the state's position on the second issue, if I may. The second issue also has an ineffective assistance of counsel component. It concerns identifying the standard of prejudice to be applied to an unobjected to failure of the court to fully instruct on an element of a charge. On this issue, the state asked the court to hold as follows. Failure to fully instruct or to instruct at all on an element of a charge, and in this case, it's failure to give the Pete Nexus instruction on possession of a dangerous weapon, is subject to harmless error analysis. And when the defendant does not object at trial to such an instructional omission, as occurred in this case, it is properly analyzed also under the two-part Strickland test for ineffective assistance of counsel.
Why don't you just say you waived it? He didn't object.
Well, I believe that it was raised on appeal as an ineffective assistance for not, because under Schumacher, the Court of Appeals has no authority to address an unobjected to instruction, but can address it in the context of ineffective assistance or interest of justice.
You're conceding error on the instruction?
On the jury instruction, yes. To the extent that the jury was instructed that on possession, on the while-armed element of the disorderly conduct charge, in language that says the jury had to find whether he did it while possessing, using, or threatening to use. Because any one of those possibilities would have sufficed if the jury found it to prove the element, and because the possession alternative requires that the possession be to facilitate the underlying crime, the disorderly conduct, that the Pete Nexus instruction probably needed to be given in addition to this basic instruction to fully instruct on the possession alternative of the dangerous weapon element.
Any strategic purpose in you making that concession?
Well, part of the argument is I don't think the jury would have even been thinking in terms of purely possession because of the conduct at issue being so much part and parcel of the disorderly conduct, taking the knives, running outside with them, and if you believe the police officer, ultimately threatening the police officer with the knife. But I believe the jury instruction probably was inadequate without at least, if it was going to use the word possession as an alternative, it probably needed to include the nexus instruction.
Well, just possession, would that have been protected by the new constitutional amendment?
I mean,
the last time the state was here on that argument, they said if somebody walked down the street with openly with a shotgun, that was they'd never charge disorderly conduct because that would be protected. Maybe I got it wrong, but I think that's what they said.
I think that's a carrying concealed weapon.
Pardon me?
I think the offense in that case is carrying a concealed weapon, and the issue is the impact.
I know,
of the
concealed. In the discussion of a concealed weapon, they said if you carried it openly,
with a shotgun.
That was okay with a shotgun.
Yes, that is the law.
I have to admit, I'm just not. I don't know the law in that particular case. Sorry.
But it makes it disorderly here because there is a nexus.
Our argument is that there was. This was, whether you look at it as harmless error, whether you look at it as ineffective assistance, whether you look at it as interest of justice, these facts, no I hate to say this, rational jury would have, or whatever test, I mean, we're arguing in terms of Strickland, which is an established test, and it seems to, at least on that issue, seems to flow from the Harvey and Tomlinson decisions, which address a case where there was preserved error. This was error that wasn't preserved. So it doesn't seem to me to make any sense. It's certainly when you're arguing in Strickland, the burden is flipped to the defendant to show prejudice, and the prejudice prong of Strickland is well established, and that it's not met in this case.
But you want us on that issue to go ahead and extend the later Harvey rule and get rid of Howard and Avila and the other cases that seem to contradict that.
Right. Harvey and Tomlinson, I believe those were cases where the omission was removing the element from the jury, telling them to accept it as proven. This is where it was not completely instructed on it or fully instructed. It would have been the same if there had been an omission of an instruction, which is really the Nader case itself, with an omission of an instruction in it. And as a threshold matter, suggesting that it's harmless error where there's omission of an element in instruction, or it's harmless error analysis applied to that.
How do you, Tomlinson was removing the instruction from the jury, so to speak. How does your position comport with the concurring opinions in Perkins? Perkins has been cited in this case. The language indicates that there's constitutional right of due process under both federal and our state constitution to ensure a criminal defendant the right to be free from conviction unless a jury finds beyond a reasonable doubt that he or she violated every element of the offense. The right would ring hollow if courts were permitted to uphold convictions based on jury instructions that fail to set forth all the elements of the particular crime at issue. How can your position be squared with that?
I believe Perkins, I'm not sure of the date on it, I apologize, I'd have to look, but Perkins, Howard, Avila, those cases did not consider Nader. And
But cites the Wisconsin Constitution also, not just the U.S.
There's a reference to it, but I guess my argument and response would be that it's not a developed in terms of the Wisconsin Constitution in the sense of that it requires a different historically or whatever the argument might be for the state constitution, that wasn't really before the court or at issue, or at least not developed, and that in this case, there's been no claim that the state constitution should be interpreted any differently than Nader interprets the federal constitution, or the conclusion in Nader that no constitutional violation, that it's subject to, it's the type of error that is subject to harmless error analysis. And I would submit that even...
Inconsistent with that language, that concurring language, though.
Nader is, I believe.
Inconsistent with the concurring language in Perkins.
Correct. As well, I believe, as the opinions in Howard and Avila as well, which remove it from a harmless error analysis. And I would ask this court, in essence, then, to Harvey was July, I believe, of this year, that it should extend it, if that's the right term, or at least follow it in this context. Moreover, this, even if this court were disinclined to go that far, this is a non-preserved error case. This is ineffective assistance. And there is precedent in this court for finding a different analysis when it's an ineffective assistance of counsel claim.
I'm a little bit confused. You ask us to, first of all, subject this to harmless error, which I think is the law in the state right now, after Harvey. But then you bring in Strickland. Why, if we are going to subject this to a harmless error analysis, and maybe I'm just dense this afternoon, do we even consider Strickland?
You wouldn't need to think of the harmless error. You could look at it just in terms of Strickland if you were inclined to say, regardless of whether a preserved error in failure to instruct the jury on an element is capable of harmless error analysis. You could say, well, we don't need to answer that question here because it wasn't preserved error. We'll look at it under Strickland.
But, and then just do it under the no prejudice.
Under the no prejudice prong, right.
Okay, so what do we do if we say that Tomlins or Harvey established the law that this kind of issue is subjected to harmless error analysis? What's that analysis then?
Well, in this
framework.
I'm sorry.
What's the framework? Do we even involve Strickland? Why would we even involve Strickland? Then wouldn't we just look at our harmless error rule and say it does or does not?
You could, but I think in the Harvey situation, if there was not an objection made, and I don't recall if there was or not, it certainly wasn't analyzed under Strickland. Mm-hmm. All I'm saying is that here you've got you're not really looking just at harmless error because it wasn't a preserved error, and the only way you can get at it is through the Strickland or ineffective or interest of justice or some other analysis. My argument is that if you're going to say that even if it had been preserved error, that there was no prejudice, in effect that it was subject to harmless error, it logically has to follow that it would be non-prejudicial under Strickland. You wouldn't have to get to the harmless error part of it. You could just jump right to Strickland. This is kind of like the Erickson case, I guess, which would be the jury peremptory strike case, where at least for a time while it was reversible error per se with the peremptory strikes, this court nonetheless said that if there wasn't preserved objection, you analyzed it under ineffective assistance of counsel and proceed that way. So, but here, if we didn't have Harvey and Tomlinson, then I think that issue of whether or not this is harmless error becomes a little more critical in the analysis. But
if we don't use the harmless error analysis, don't we end up then with Howard and Avila and that line of cases on the books, which might be misinterpreted as far as the future is concerned based on your arguments?
I think you're right. I don't want to step on any toes because the court viewed, obviously, at one point that the law where there was a removal of an element or a directed verdict on an... Well, I want to say, let me backtrack from the directed verdict, but that it was automatic prejudicial error, that it was removing it from the fact finder. And I think it's hard to square Howard and Avila with Harvey and Tomlinson unless you do that, and I think it could cause confusion. I'm just suggesting that if the court wanted to not confront that directly at this point, it could jump right to Strickland, I believe.
But if Harvey and Avila are still good law, then the defendant is entitled to an automatic reversal, which makes the Strickland analysis...
Yeah, I guess you're right.
I mean, it's gotta
be right.
I'm sorry.
You're right. You're right. I guess you couldn't really do that, could you? Because if it was automatically reversible error per se, even if it wasn't objected to error, you're right. You persuaded me that I think you have to find that I think you have to go the whole
take
route.
Take much
I
persuasion.
Think. I don't know.
No. But I'm sorry. But I think logically that would make sense because I think so.
In Tomlinson and Harvey, sure. There was, in essence, no instructions given because the jury was told this element is satisfied.
In so many words, yeah. Baseball bat is a dangerous weapon.
Yeah, absolute words. It was the baseball bat is a dangerous weapon or whatever the language was. And in Harvey... The issue was that this was within X feet of the school, 1,000 feet of the park. So here, in those two cases, you have no instruction on an element of the crime, right?
Correct.
And the court says...
I think. I'm not sure if they may have been instructed, but then the court adds this to it. I'm not sure if... You know, in other words...
Oh, the jury, the element is taken away from the jury.
Essentially, right.
Okay. Now, you have other cases that say if you give an instruction that omits one element, that's prejudicial error. How can those two lines of cases stand together?
I don't think they can, probably. I don't think so, not logically.
If you do the major part of just not even bothering to give an instruction, and that's not prejudicial,
So if you just make a little error.
Well, I would even go so far to say that the, in this case, omitting instruction probably is less egregious, if that's possible, than
giving
than
a wrong
telling them that they have to accept it.
Yeah,
so because here, there's, yeah, they could have found it with, you know, they weren't told they had to, but.
The jury had been instructed here that there was a nexus, right? That would have fit right within Tomlinson and Harvey.
Right, right. If they had been told that they didn't need to worry about it because there was one, right.
And here they're not even told, so they don't worry about it, right?
Correct. Correct.
So there it goes, right?
I think, I don't.
Does the jury have to be given any instructions under Harvey and Tomlinson?
Any instructions at all?
Any instructions on anything?
On the element?
Hey, listen, this is robbery. If you think he committed robbery, go ahead and convict him.
Right. I think.
But enough?
No.
Sarah?
Probably not.
Oh, but it's clear as anything.
Right.
This guy committed robbery. I mean, it is absolutely clear. And in addition to that, in conclusion, the trial counsel says, he's probably guilty of robbery, but don't do it. Don't convict him anyway. Harmless error?
In that circumstance,
two counts, you got
yeah,
two okay. harmless errors. Two wrongs make a wrong in this case.
Well, I think you have to look at the. In your situation, I guess I would say that it probably wasn't harmless error because it removed too much. I think Nader is a very limited harmless error test. And in fact, it discusses, I believe, defines the application of the test in language such something like where there was no real controversy or no dispute of facts on that particular element, where in effect the way the trial proceeded, nobody really was contesting that element. There was no reason to worry about that element in terms of the trial evidence. So I think if you have a situation where...
Was Harvey and Tomlinson that narrow?
Probably not. I'm sorry, I just don't...
Pardon me?
I'm not sure. I don't think so. I think Harvey was just the one element situation also, correct? It's just the baseball bat. They're directing the jury on a particular element that such and such is satisfied by definition. I'm not sure I'm totally answering your question, but...
Well...
I mean, I think there are situations where you're not going to be able to say that it's... I think there may be harmless error analysis available based on Nader and Harvey, but it's a very limited situation where you're going to actually find harmless error. I think that's what I want to say.
Let me, if I may, follow up on that, because I just don't understand. If you have a guy who pleads guilty to burglary, the evidence comes in, and I don't know what he was doing, wasting our time. I mean, he's contesting it, but he's guilty of sin. And for some reason, as a trial judge, I blow it, and I give the jury lots of instructions, and I just don't give them the substantive instruction on burglary. I just don't. I missed it. Under the harmless error test, I could say, hey, that guy's guilty of sin, and I can say beyond a reasonable doubt that the error complained of didn't contribute to the verdict. He was guilty. I mean, you want guilty? That guy is guilty. So it seems to me, under your argument, that you can not even give the instruction, but if the evidence is strong enough, it passes the harmless error test.
I would suggest the court needn't go that far. I'm suggesting that looking at just at this case, at a single element, one element, an element, moreover, that there was no real controversy about, no dispute that he had these knives and this was part and parcel of the disorder.
What's wrong with going that far? I mean, isn't that, is that your understanding of what the
law? Well, I guess, is? I mean, I suppose...
But I'm talking about what your understanding of the law is in this state.
Well, I guess it would be, you'd have to look at what happened at trial to say, suppose there was a two-element offense, and you neither, there was no instruction at all, and the evidence came in such a way that one of the elements clearly was, well, like this case, one of the elements clearly wasn't controverted. There was, even the defendant admitted that part, that element, that act. If there is controverted evidence on the other element, and the court fails to instruct on that element as well, I would suggest you have a problem, that, or we have, the state has a problem, that it's applying harmless error, I think, in that situation may be difficult to justify because, as a matter of reality, you've got a controverted element.
And that's your understanding of the holding of Nader.
That's
that
correct.
You needed. But is that your understanding of the holding of Harvey and Tomlinson? And the answer is you don't know right now.
I mean, I'd really have to look at it closely to give you a better answer. I apologize. I hadn't thought through it that far to give you to how far to go.
Wouldn't the absence, complete absence of jury instructions on the substantive offense be considered a structural error? And besides that, it's never going to happen. A trial judge is not going to fail to instruct.
It's hard to argue that it wouldn't be a structural error. I mean, if the jury doesn't know what it's supposed to find, I mean, I would think so. It's the category of thing that I haven't seen any case law on it to know that it's ever happened. But I would, you know, it's a matter of degree, I guess, at some point, and I guess my bottom line argument here is this court needn't go that far, because we're talking about a situation that is amenable to the Nader analysis, is amenable to the Harvey and Tomlinson analysis.
Well, the Nader analysis, the Harvey, Tomlinson, Nader analysis is quite clear, I think, that this was constitutional error, failing to give the instruction. No question about it. It violated the basic concept that the jury must decide every element. The court spent a lot of time doing that and very clearly said this was a constitutional violation, but then said that an instructional error, you apply the harmless error test, and that under Nader, a jury instruction that improperly omitted an element is subject to the harmless error test. And the test is that is it so intrinsically harmful as to require automatic reversal? And then the court said there are very few that require that. Maybe failure to have counsel is one, but not necessarily ineffective assistance of counsel. And the issue is, let's see, that the presumption is the court considered this test to be essentially consistent on harmless error, and it uses, does the appellate court think that there was evidence beyond a reasonable doubt to find him guilty of the crime for which the wrong instruction was given? Isn't that the test?
Well, if I may quote from my brief and from Nader, this isn't from Harvey per se, but from Nader, and this is what I was operating under. The bottom of page 27 of my brief from Nader. A reviewing court making this harmless error inquiry, and again we're talking about one element, does not become, in effect, the second jury to determine whether the defendant is guilty. Rather, a court in typical appellate court fashion asks whether the record contains evidence that could rationally lead to a contrary finding with respect to the omitted element. If the answer to that question is no, holding the error harmless does not reflect a denigration of the constitutional rights involved. On the contrary, it serves a very useful purpose insofar as it blocks setting aside convictions for small errors or defects that have, if any, likelihood of having changed the result of the trial. Again, I haven't thought about where you go more than one element or you go all the elements, and my guess would be all the elements would be probably a structural defect. how many elements, I think you have to look at it case by case. That's the best answer I can give you now. I'd be happy to supplement if you'd like, but I hadn't thought about it, so I don't have a better answer for you at this point. I'm seeing probably way over my time, so I better stop.
Thank you, Mr. Frymer. Mr. Weiss.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Steve Weiss. I'm from the Public Defender Appeals Office, and I'm representing Mr. Gordon, the respondent in this proceeding. There are two issues, as the Attorney General set out. I'll begin with the first issue. The first issue concerns whether or not this court believes that it is an appropriate lawyer's decision rather than client's decision to, in effect, plead guilty to the jury in the hopes of obtaining a successful outcome on some other counts in a multi-count case. That's exactly what happened here. He was charged with one felony and two misdemeanors, Mr. Gordon. His attorney, at the closing argument, said to the jury, and this was found by the trial judge, that this was a concession of guilt, that we are not contesting, I'm paraphrasing rather than quoting, we are not contesting the conviction for disorderly conduct. However, we would like you to acquit him of the other misdemeanor and the felony. Based on that record, the trial judge agreed it was a complete concession of error and then found it harmless. The Court of Appeals found that concession of guilt was the functional equivalent of a guilty plea. The Court of Appeals was unanimous in that regard. There was a dissent from Judge Fine with respect to the second issue that we'll discuss later. Now, the best analogy that I can give this court about what happened in this case involves plea bargaining, pretrial. Everyone knows that no court anywhere would allow a defense lawyer to go up to the prosecutor and say, Mr. Prosecutor, we've got three charges here. If you allow my guy to plead to counts one and three, I'm sorry, if you allow my guy to plead to count two and dismiss counts one and three, we have a deal. Dismiss those two, and I will plead on behalf of my client, because I'm certain that my client, that this is in his best interests. Or conversely, even in the situation that was discussed in the state's briefs, the lesser included offense situation, this court would never allow a defense attorney to go up to the prosecutor pretrial and plead the client into a lesser included offense, no matter how great the deal was. If the client was charged with murder and the prosecutor, the defense lawyer said, well, we're going to go in the court and we'll have a little conference with the judge and we'll plead him into disorderly conduct and he can go home, no matter how great that deal was, it would absolutely require the client's consent for the lawyer to do that.
And can I interrupt?
You can always interrupt.
Line of thought, what procedurally should have occurred here? Should the defense counsel before closings have asked to make a record of his client's strategic position about that disorderly conduct?
I think that would certainly be the neatest, cleanest, and best procedure to follow. It would be a very short one or two moment colloquy during the instruction conference, for example, which generally takes place prior to the closings, where the lawyer would say that, Judge, we're going to be involved in this tactic, and with my client's consent, I am going to concede guilt and ask him to acquit on the other counts. And the judge at that point, as they do in a Wallerman, where you're stipulating to an element for tactical reasons, and this court has required the client's express on the record consent.
But
to simply say, Mr. Client, do you agree and consent that your attorney will, in effect, tell the jury that you would like to be convicted of this count in exchange for their acquittals on these other counts? It would be as simple as that.
Does the judge then go through a banger colloquy tantamount to taking a plea?
I think somewhat abbreviated version of that, since there's been evidence, there's been a trial, so the factual basis and such wouldn't have to be gone into any particular detail.
Well, then why submit it to the jury at all?
I'm not sure.
I submitted to the jury if you don't plead guilty.
Because if the client isn't specifically pleading guilty, we have to, but it gets so blurred as a line where we're going to allow the lawyer to, in a sense, argue the guilt to the jury, that I don't see really the distinction. I mean, it has to go to the jury because there was a not guilty plea entered. However, certainly if a client is going to consent to that tactic, it would still get submitted to the jury, but the argument seemingly would make it unnecessary for the jury to spend much time on the issue.
What would be the prosecution's tactics then, knowing that, in other words, this is brought before the judge, it's judge, this is what we plan to do. Prosecution, what is then sitting on their hands as to the tactic? In other words, what does the prosecution do, or could they do anything about that?
Well, presumably.
As far as their discussion to the jury, their closing statement, that's what I'm asking. Would they say, this is a trial tactic, ladies and gentlemen, whatever, you've already had that argument has been, so the jury has heard this, they're going to wonder what happened to that.
And I presume that at the point where the defense lawyer and the client have together decided to undertake that tactic, if I were the prosecutor, I would say, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, your work has just been made easier. I believe the defendant's lawyer is going to tell you that he's not even contesting count two, so I'm going to focus my attention on the other counts that I'd like you to convict him of.
Nothing.
Say thank you and move on. What else would he need to do? Maybe I'm not understanding the question.
I just wanted to see what your thought was.
I would take it as a gift if I were the prosecutor. It's one count that they're conceding to the jury. And then I would focus my attention on getting convictions on the other two counts, as the prosecutor did in this case.
Why isn't this more analogous to the situation where the defense attorney argues that the lesser included is a more appropriate charge to convict the defendant on?
I think it is somewhat analogous, and I think, personally, there are no Wisconsin cases specifically on this point. I would urge the court not to jump in too quickly in that area. If the defendant wants to go to trial and demands of his attorney an all-or-nothing trial, I do not believe that attorney ethically has the right to submit a lesser-included offense and argue for a conviction on a lesser-included offense against his client's wishes. If the client says, I was not there, was not me, and the defense attorney thinks, well, I can get a second-degree murder verdict instead of a first-degree verdict, and goes ahead and uses that tactic against his client's will, I promise I'll be before this court saying it was wrong.
But we don't typically, I don't think there's a case on this, you just suggested that there isn't, require an on-the-record waiver and colloquy with the judge, waiver by the defendant and colloquy with the judge, when a lesser-included offense instruction is given, and that argument is made before the jury. That's not part of our trial practice, and I don't think there's a case that requires that.
No, I agree with that. I would say that if indeed it was happening over the client's objection, there would be a proceeding in this, as there was in this case, where there would be an ineffective counsel claim raised post-trial, and I would be standing before you in that circumstance suggesting that if a lawyer is going to inject a lesser included into a case where the client wanted an all or nothing, that there would have to be a colloquy for that purpose. I think the client gets to make certain decisions. If the client says, it's not me, I wasn't there, the lawyer has to respect that. And in this case, Mr. Gordon pled not guilty to each of the three charges. And it may have been a wise tactic as lawyers that we might sit around and say, boy, I'd sure like to be able to just do that. But some things we just can't do. The lawyer might have wanted to take a plea bargain.
Mr. Weiss, why isn't the analysis under ineffective assistance of counsel sufficient to cover this situation from your point of view?
I think it was. The case was raised in the context of ineffective assistance of counsel.
So you have no problem with the court taking the approach that we're going to look at whether or not there was ineffective assistance of counsel when this type of a concession is made by counsel with or without consent. Is that right?
I think that is correct, and I think that's exactly what the Court of Appeals did.
Well, but you have to be careful, counsel. You go into ineffective assistance to counsel, you're in harmless error. Your argument is that this is a structural error.
You're also into the issue of prejudice.
A harmless error and prejudice are two sides of the coin. But your argument is that, it seems to me, has to be that you don't get to harmless error because it had to be done with the consent. Well, here's my question. Is it with the consent of the client and that the client has to tell the judge personally? Or is with the consent of the client enough so that the Machna hearing is sufficient?
I think, let me answer this in reverse order, because one's going to be shorter and easier than the other. I think the Machna hearing is certainly sufficient. I think that having the colloquy at the moment with the trial judge prior to the closing argument would certainly avoid needless post-conviction proceedings leading to Machna hearings, which will lead to conclusions. So the answer is yes, a Machna hearing is sufficient. No, I don't think it's the cleanest, neatest, easiest, best practice.
Well, if you get a Machna hearing and it shows he didn't consent, then is your position it's a, you go to harmless error, or is your position that it's structural and that that's it?
I'm going to give sort of a mixed answer because what we're getting into here, and I addressed in my brief, it's the interplay between the Strickland prejudice test following a finding of deficient performance and the Chronic test. And Chronic was decided the same time as Strickland. And in the one case, they said, we're going to have to go back and find prejudice, and it's going to be the defendant's obligation to demonstrate prejudice, and that fell into the Strickland side. But then the court said, in Chronic, some errors are so obvious and the prejudice is so plain that we're not even going to put the litigants and the trial courts to the trouble of relitigating them on the prejudice question. And most of the courts, and this is addressed in the briefs of both of the parties, most of the courts have looked at the attorney's concession of guilt to the jury as falling within the Chronic presumed prejudice. It's not that there's no prejudice or no harmless error, it's simply that the error is so obvious and so blatant that we're not even going to waste ink or time on litigating the prejudice aspect. So when I suggested,
you said it is a Counselor, I've just been looking at page 12 of your brief, where you're 11 when you start citing Chronic and make this argument. But even you yourself head your argument with the words prejudice should be presumed. Now, I read your brief in two different ways. You seem to be saying on the one hand that when this is done, it's an automatic reversal. But then you use the word presume, and every time I see the word presume, I think, well, then the state has an opportunity to respond. So then it's not automatic. So what is it, automatic or not?
I don't think I said in my brief that there should be automatic reversal. I said I think it's a regular Strickland analysis, but once we find deficient performance, we move over to the Chronic scale, and we don't even have to show prejudice. But I also would point out, and did point out in the brief, that in this case, I think even under the Strickland test, Mr. Gordon could show prejudice here.
Right, but
either way. And what the Court of Appeals said, I believe, was that they adopted the Chronic view that they would presume prejudice provided there was no consent and remanded for a Machna hearing simply on the question of consent.
You say prejudice should be presumed. That's what the heading of is on page 11. The word presumed leads me to believe that the state has an opportunity then to overcome it. So maybe you're not meaning the word presumed. Maybe you mean prejudice is present in cases per se.
I thought you were arguing for a per se rule, but then I use the word presume, and I think, well, if it's a presumption, then the state can come in and show that there was no prejudice.
I think it becomes a matter of degree between the Strickland test and the Cronic test. Cronic uses language to the effect that where no challenge is made whatsoever to the state's case, prejudice is, they use the word, I believe, presumed in the Cronic case itself.
Well, you can have a presumption that is not rebuttable.
There are such things in the law.
In our juror bias cases, we use the phrase prejudice per se. I mean, that's a phrase we used.
Correct. And I think that in this situation, I think the wiser, easier rule is that prejudice is presumed, which would lead to an automatic reversal, provided there was no consent. However, in Cronic, they never exactly used the word structural error, that I can recall. If the court is right up on that, you may correct me.
They used it in other cases, and Harvey uses it to mean an error that is prejudicial per se, that goes to the very heart of it. And we're not going to look so intrinsically harmful as to require automatic reversal.
Yes, and this court has certainly used the term automatic reversal on more than one occasion in its prior cases concerning the second issue that we'll get up to shortly, I'm sure.
Before we get up to that, didn't Mr. Gordon essentially admit on the witness stand facts sufficient to constitute?
No, absolutely not, Justice Fikes. Our opinion, and this goes into more of a factual discussion of the case, and I would point out that even the state has found itself in a position of arguing on the one hand that it's absolutely implicit and there's no discussion at all, and then in its own brief, I believe it's on page 20, the state suggests that Gordon's counsel actually challenged the conviction for disorderly conduct by cross-examining Ms. Wilder concerning the innocuousness of Mr. Gordon's behavior.
Inside the house, right?
Inside the house.
We're talking a situation that flowed outside the house and continued on, is the gravamen of the disorderly conduct.
Well, see, that's another problem in this case and why it becomes more complex on the facts. The prosecutor, in his argument to the jury, made absolutely clear that the gravamen of the case, as you put it, was the conduct inside the house. I've cited in my brief at record number 48, page 84, the district attorney says to the jury that he was disorderly while he was in that house. He was disorderly and he was armed with two knives. Was ordered to drop those knives by the police officers and slammed the door and ran away. So the district attorney never, ever considered that the disorderly conduct took place anywhere except in that apartment prior to and up to the moment where Gordon fled. Now, Gordon's defense lawyer, of course, during his concession of guilt said, oh, well, we of course concede he was guilty of disorderly conduct running around the neighborhood with knives like that late at night. So there's a real problem there on the facts.
Well, beyond what the DA was arguing, there was all kinds of testimony to the conduct that occurred outside the house as well as inside the house.
There was testimony, yes, but the clear gravamen of that charge was the inside the house conduct as the prosecutor chose his charges.
And the Court of Appeals speaks inconsistently to this point when it says on the first issue that there's going to have to be a hearing, a Lochner hearing, on the issue of consent or non-consent to the confession made during closing argument, and then when it's addressing the second issue, it says at paragraph 36, After all, given Gordon's testimony, which appears to concede guilt to the charge of disorderly conduct while armed, reversal is certainly not required in the interest of justice.
That's
what we
certainly,
do with that?
I think it's inconsistent, and I think you could simply chalk it up for what it is. It's inconsistent.
Does your whole position on the first issue depend upon the equivalency of the concession of guilt to a guilty plea? We have to say, in order to find for you, that those two things are equivalent.
Equivalent? I think that they're legally exactly the same. I think it's close enough for government work.
Well, there's lots of cases that say the opposite, though, right?
There are
plenty of cases that say the opposite, that a concession of the overwhelming nature of the proofs on a lesser included offense or a lesser charge in a multiple count case is not tantamount to a guilty plea without the client's consent.
I would say that a few cases say that. I think most of the cases do say exactly my position, including, as I put in my brief, the Seventh Circuit cases that the state relied upon outside of the Underwood case. And I think the Court of Appeals also came to the conclusion that the majority of the case law does treat that type of closing argument concession as the functional equivalent of an admission of guilt. We may disagree on that, but I think that's how I read the cases, and that's why I read the majority of the cases.
How many cases are we talking about, Mr. Weiss?
How many?
I mean, if there are three cases and the majority is two, that's one thing.
No. Both briefs have cited, rather lengthy. It's probably the longest string cite I've ever used in a brief in this court. I'll give you a quick tally if you'd like. It's certainly probably up into the number 20s of courts that have considered the issue.
Page 8?
Page 8 and page 9 of my brief. And
okay, that's good enough.
Likewise, the state's brief at pages 15 and 16 through 18. But I would say there's well over 20 state and federal courts that have considered the issue.
Mr. Weiss, in the wake of the defendant's testimony about his possession of the knives, what is the proper way for defense counsel to argue that he's not guilty of disorderly conduct while armed?
Well, if we apply the proper legal standards to a conviction for the penalty enhancer of while armed, the defense attorney could very simply have pointed out that in no way did the knives actually facilitate the disorderly conduct whatsoever. He wasn't charged with escaping at knife point, in which case he used the knife perhaps to escape, although the facts don't support that. In many ways, if he was disorderly, through his conduct in the apartment, he was disorderly with the knives or without the knives. And my understanding of the Pete decision is that if the knives did not actually facilitate or attempt to facilitate the commission of the offense, then he's not guilty of the while armed. And I don't see in this case, and I'm not sure if is the state willing to concede perhaps, that but for the knives there would be no conviction for disorderly conduct. Then maybe we have a different case.
Counsel, is it necessary, if you would prevail on the first issue, is it necessary to get to the Pete issue? The first issue deals with the allegedly unilateral concession to the disorderly conduct charge. Disorderly conduct while armed charge. Okay. And it seems to be your position that if this is unilateral, that it is ineffective assistance of counsel. Maybe a remand has to take place to determine indeed if it is unilateral. But if it is unilateral, it is ineffective assistance of counsel. And given this concession or functional equivalent, prejudice is presumed, and therefore the conviction is on that charge is overturned. So then why do we get to Pete? Because Pete deals with the same charge. I'm not sure that you are going to prevail on that first issue, but if you did prevail on the first issue, why do we address the second issue if the conviction is overturned? Why do we care about whether or not there was an instruction on that issue?
I agree completely. The first issue would be dispositive if the Court of Appeals is affirmed on the unanimous determination concerning...
Oh, but the Court of Appeals sent it back for Mockner. What if we sent it back for a Mockner hearing? We then have to determine the second issue.
Only if the Mockner hearing developed that it was not a concession.
Well, yeah.
I mean, that it was not consented.
But no one's debating, are they, that this instruction was erroneous. Everybody agrees the instruction was erroneous.
On the second issue, correct.
On the second issue, the only debate here is whether or not that will defeat the conviction. So well, if you find that that under the Mockner hearing, well, I guess I talked myself out of it.
No, if I'm understanding what the court is asking, there are two separate convictions with two separate issues involved.
I'm sorry.
There's one conviction with two parts. Yeah. I beg pardon. They're severable to the extent that in Pete and in the other cases, this court has said that the underlying substantive crime may survive a defect in the enhanced instruction.
Well, if we,
so if this court says the substantive conviction is reversed pursuant to the Court of Appeals decision, then the Pete issue, the enhancement issue, does not have to be reached because there's an entire retrial on the entire crime.
Only depending on what happens.
Depending on what happens in the trial court.
That was the footnote I was going to add. Is provided
and
that,
which is why we have to address the second issue.
Or one could wait and see.
Well, I suppose, but I don't know if my colleagues are ready to move on to the second issue.
I guess I will.
If we are, could you tell me why Harvey does not control?
Sure, I could start there, I suppose. I think for several reasons Harvey doesn't control this issue. It's distinguishable in various ways. I had the good fortune to argue the Harvey case for a colleague of mine who was ill.
He won,
sort of.
Now you may lose.
I believe he's still in prison.
Is that how you define a win?
Over at our shop.
How do you define a lose?
Over at our shop, we have these guys, they call them clients, that we have to deal with. I think first the first clear distinction, and I think this is how I interpret the court's Harvey decision, is that Harvey involved an erroneous jury instruction and a directed verdict instruction. The jury in Harvey was instructed as to both elements of the penalty enhancer, and then the judge said, and by the way, Penn Park is a park in the city, which was removing one of the elements from their consideration by way of a directed verdict, but the jury was told you have to find these two things, plus I'm going to tell you what to find on the second one. This case, there is no instruction whatsoever given on the Pete nexus, and that becomes important when we look at this court's prior decisions in Perkins, in Howard, in Avila, in Pete, and the Court of Appeals opinion in Krieger, where a great distinction is made between an erroneous instruction, even to the point that included a conclusive presumption, and the complete absence of an instruction on an element at all. And this Court has always made the distinction there and said if there's no element, to use your words, there's an automatic reversal. But if there is an instruction that gives the element, but it's erroneous, then we can review it for harmless error.
Does that distinction really make any difference?
Oh, it makes a great deal of difference in this case, certainly.
Why?
Because in this case, there was no instruction as opposed to an erroneous instruction that gave the element with a presumption.
There's overwhelming evidence. Let's assume for a moment that we conclude that there's overwhelming evidence that these knives were used to facilitate the crime of disorderly conduct. which is the nexus. Why can't we subject that to a harmless error analysis the same as we did to when there's an erroneous instruction? It seems to me, following Justice Sykes's question, that there are times when it's better to give no instruction than to give an erroneous instruction.
Well, I think for the very reasons that this court set out in, particularly in the Avila case, and as Justice Wilcox, citing back to the Howard case in his concurrence in Perkins, explained that there's a very big difference between reviewing a jury verdict after the jury had been instructed on each element to determine whether or not that verdict, which lives as an entity, can be supported by the record despite the error, or whether we have a situation where the jury never signed off on one of the essential elements. And I think that's a very real distinction, and I honestly can't set it out with any more clarity than did Justice Wilcox. But there is a real difference. If you have a valid verdict, but it was obtained through error because the verdict encompassed each essential element, that's one thing. But if you have a verdict that was reached without consideration of an essential portion, that's a different kind of creature.
Doesn't this case fall squarely within Nader? In Nader, there was an omission of an element. It wasn't a conclusive presumption instruction.
That's correct. And what I can say to that is it is similar to the case in Nader. However, I could go on for hours about Nader and Apprendi. I think that Nader is genuinely a questionable case right now in the United States Supreme Court. They have never really addressed the interplay between the Apprendi case, in which they reversed a conviction where the judge made a finding over undisputable evidence on a penalty enhancer.
That was a facial challenge to the statute.
Well, but the way the court decided the case in Apprendi, they said that every element of the penalty enhancer required a jury determination.
Right, but that wasn't instructional error, either omission of an element or instruction that constituted a conclusive presumption. It was a facial challenge of the statutory scheme in New Jersey for the hate crimes law that gave the judge the right to determine hate crimes, not the jury. So that's a very different situation. The two don't even cross.
Oh, I guess I just would have to beg to differ. I think they cross very much. They haven't discussed it yet. But what's really interesting to me is if you look at the composition of the U.S. Supreme Court, that the four dissenters, Nader was a 5-4 case, the four dissenters became the majority in Apprendi, joined by Justice Thomas, while the four people left from the majority of Nader became the dissenters in Apprendi. So I think there's a very interesting intellectual crossover there as to exactly what's going on. And Justice Scalia's dissent in Nader and his concurrence in Apprendi, as does Justice Stevens' separate writing in Nader, I think makes the cases very relevant to each other. In terms of the real issue that we're dealing with here, to get to the real heart of the matter, going back to this court's, prior cases, is exactly what makes a trial by jury. What exactly does have to go to the jury before you can have a jury trial? If a judge takes half of the elements away, or doesn't instruct on half, is that a trial by jury? Two-thirds? Three-quarters supermajority? Three-quarters? A trial by jury has to mean something. And I think in Apprendi, they said that. My time is up.
Justice Babbage has a question.
Counsel, I'd like you to give us your best shot on this one, and I know you don't have any time left, but the question, assuming that we say that this is subject to harmless error analysis, what's your best shot in saying that this was not harmless error?
On the Pete issue? Or?
Yeah. On the fact that this was not... My proposition to you is that there was overwhelming evidence that this crime of disorderly conduct was facilitated with guns, and therefore it's harmless error. What's your answer to that?
The answer is I don't think that there's overwhelming evidence to that effect. Anytime we get into harmless error, we argue facts. The evidence was, and as the state pointed out in its brief when they were trying to defend the lawyer's actions, pointed out that he cross-examined the witness, and that the witness, the woman who owned the home, said he was never threatening with the knives. He never made any gestures with the knives. He simply
I didn't know if you wanted me to wait.
I'm not talking. I'm just coughing. But I'll talk in a moment. Are you done?
No, let me just finish real quickly. That he never made any threatening gestures with the knives. He picked up the knives, turned around, ran out the door, and slammed it behind him.
And then what about out at the outside? And I know your argument that this is not the gravamen of the defense, but let's assume that it is, that it's part of it.
Gravamen of the prosecution.
Gravamen of the prosecution. And the officer, I believe, testified that he came after him. He felt threatened.
He did testify he felt threatened, and he shot him. I would say to that, despite the fact that it's not the gravamen of the offense, it's not the crime that the prosecution charged and convicted him of, is then we get to the situation where whether or not what the jury might have done or what a lawyer might have done who was arguing the case. If I were arguing the case, I would certainly be pointing out that the prosecutor said it occurred in the apartment. So I think it's far from open and shut that he admitted through his own testimony this action. Did he have knives? Absolutely. Were he charged with fleeing? Perhaps the knives facilitated fleeing. The last point I would make on that regard is that I don't think that the state or this court or anyone would agree that there was no disorderly conduct absent the knives. And then I would say from there, ergo, the knives did not facilitate the disorderly conduct. They were ancillary to it. If the knives were the gravamen of the disorderly conduct, by inference then I would argue that it was not a proper enhancement case because it was sort of be like being a felon in possession of a weapon and getting a weapons enhancer on that. So if you had to have the knives for the disorderly conduct and that was the disorderliness, then there's no enhancer.
Mr. Weiss, I thought you were going to answer Mr. Justice Stablish by saying, look, under Perkins, Howard, Pete, Krieger, and Avila, omission of an element is per se reversible error. And that if you want to apply the harmless error test of Harvey and Tomlinson, you have to reverse those decisions, overturn those decisions. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. I did say that in my brief. I thought Justice Babbage was asking a fact-specific question. Perhaps I misunderstood. Yeah, clearly under the law, this court has a choice to make. This court is either going to overrule all of those unanimous decisions, including Perkins, or this court is going to have to start limiting and thinking about exactly where it went in Harvey.
All of those decisions were pre-Nader.
That's not true.
Which postdated Nader?
I believe.
And they were certainly pre-Harvey.
Clearly pre-Harvey.
Pre-Harvey.
My recollection is that Perkins...
Well, Perkins was a concurrence, right? So
well,
the
Perkins
opinion
was, no.
being cited there is a concurrence. It's not a majority opinion that's being cited, right?
Well, it's both. The majority opinion required the reversal because the element was not submitted and indicated there would be an automatic reversal under Howard, and then the concurrence further expanded on that in Perkins.
That wasn't another facial challenge of the statute in Perkins?
Not exactly.
Nader was 1999, so any case after 1999 would be raise that issue. Okay, we can check that out. Thank you.
The dates are, I just couldn't lay my hands on the index that quickly.
Nader is, I just looked at that up. It's 1999. Okay. Mr. Frymuth?
Thank you. I'd like to address the first issue, if I may. I didn't get a large opportunity to do that in the opening argument. I think the threshold question for the court on the first issue is whether this claim of ineffective counsel falls under Chronic, where I think it's Chronic stands for prejudice per se, versus Strickland, where you're applying the two-part test. And I think this falls under Strickland and not Chronic to the extent there's a continuum here that's being followed. Because it was not, in the words of Chronic, it was not tantamount to a complete failure to subject the prosecution's case to meaningful adversarial testing. As I indicated earlier, this was there was no removal of any element from the jury. There was no waiver of any jury rights, cross-examination, and and presenting of evidence. This was not a guilty plea. This was a strategic decision of counsel based on the entire record of trial made at closing argument. And I'll get into the factors that I think are, I'll try to be quick here, that I think are important. But I'd also like to suggest that if it were otherwise, you could have a defense attorney who recognizes that a trial on a particular charge isn't going very well, and in order to get a new trial on it, unilaterally decide, I'm going to just concede guilt on this charge, and we're not going to win it anyway, I'm going to take the risk, and because I didn't get your consent, and I needed your consent, therefore, you're going to get automatic reversal, and maybe we'll have a better chance the next time around. That's the danger, I think, if you're going to not view this in terms of a strategic decision in Strickland. Now, that's not to say that there can't be cases where it is ineffective assistance because there was a dispute of evidence, because, or because perhaps it was opening argument, or I'm sorry, opening statement. I'm not saying that automatically if it was made an opening statement, but it's a much tougher case because their counsel hasn't, in effect, really subjected the case to the adversarial process of trial. I also want to note that the Court of Appeals' opinion in trying to resolve this issue is not, at least to the state's mind, not very workable. They talk about a semantic kind of argument of counsel. They suggest, and I believe it's at 14 to 17 of the slip opinion, that merely acknowledging the weight of evidence is different from evidence of guilt is different from saying the defendant is guilty. Well, again, there's a whole range of statements that could be made by defense counsel at closing argument, and where you're going to draw the line as to which is going too far and which is in conceding and which is not really a concession but sort of an acknowledgement, I just don't think that's a workable distinction.
Speaking of those sorts of practicalities, do you read the Court of Appeals opinion as requiring trial court judges to make a record with a personal colloquy with each defendant whenever there's a lesser included?
I don't read it that way, and I think that's problematic. I mean, I think you either have to have a guilty plea colloquy if this is going to be a guilty plea and remove it from the trial, from the jury, or you're going to have a situation where it isn't a complete concession. I mean, it isn't a guilty plea, and you're going to let the jury make the decision even though you recognize that it's likely to be he's likely to be found guilty, and your strategy is to try to save him on the greater charge. I just think the Court of Appeals decision is not workable. It doesn't make a lot of sense. And I think there is Wisconsin case law that comes very close, at least in the lesser included, and it is on page 18 of my brief. In particular, the Green case that's cited in the last paragraph of the brief, which is a 1968 decision of this court. If counsel's decision to forego a lesser included offense instruction is reasonable strategy, the defendant, quote, is bound by a waiver exercised by counsel in the course of trial, even though not consulted. And in the preceding paragraph to that, there are other cases that suggest that whether or not to argue for a lesser included offense is the type of decision that's a strategic decision. And this is another species of that. This is where the guilt is overwhelming on a lesser charge. I'm going to try to save you on the greater charge. By acknowledging just that, so that your credibility on the greater charge is not destroyed.
Counsel, do you dispute your opposing counsel's premise that the majority of cases do deal with concession as a functional equivalent of a guilty plea?
I do not. I don't have a counting to say which is which. There is a list of cases in both briefs that address it, and counting them up would be the way to go. There is some dispute out there. I'll acknowledge that, but I think it's the way you resolve that is to look at it case by case under Strickland and look at the particular charges, the particular count that is being conceded, to make that kind of a determination. Just in closing, real quick, I see my lights up. We're not advocating a bright line test here. We're advocating applying Strickland and the four factors that I cited. I'm just suggesting that when you've got those, you got to find that it was not ineffective assistance. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Farmer. Thank you, Mr. Weiss. That ends the hearing on 01-1679 CR, and that concludes our October oral arguments. What is adjourned?